It's Thursday, April 5th, 2012, and you're listening to episode 263 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 53 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name is Pat.
This is Johan.
And this is Chris.
You guys always do that to me. I adjust your sound levels, and we start the show, and you get a lot louder.
Did I get louder?
Yes. I did. I know.
Really? Yeah, I got a bad
pad off. It's actually talking. All right, we got several things to run down here real quick. First off, Fear the Con 5 still coming up. I did want to talk about a couple of charities that are going to be run at the convention this year. Now, we are not personally doing these. However, we definitely support them and stand behind what's going on here. So I want you guys to know about them. A gentleman by the name of Derek is going to be running three charities, and I'll put a link in the show notes to more details, but I'll try to at least give you a real quick version of the three charity events here on the show. All of these will support Gamers Outreach, which you can find at gamersoutreach.org, which is something like Child's Play, but a little bit broader, where they support trying to get like video game kiosks available in hospitals to people of all ages, and also available troops overseas. And they have a bunch of stuff they do. It's a pretty diverse organization. Throughout the convention, he'll be selling $10 raffle tickets. 100% of the proceeds will go to this charity. And at the start of slot 6, he will do a drawing. You must be present to win. And the drawing will be for a 16 gigabyte iPad 2 with a Belkin keyboard folio.
Wow.
The second thing he's going to be doing is he wants to get together some letters for soldiers, deployed soldiers. There's one that he would like to have passed around and signed by everyone at the convention. If you would like to bring a letter of your own for a random soldier, okay, this will just be sent to a person that the military, you know, deems does not receive a lot of contact or could use a morale boost, then feel free to write and bring your own. Just be sure to bring it in an open and unmarked envelope. And I say open just because if we're sending this, we need to make sure we're responsible about what the content of these letters are.
So don't be a tool.
Pretty much. Just don't be a jackass and we'll be fine with it.
Hey, you know, speaking of that, one of the friends of my oldest son, he's in the Marines, and when he was off at boot camp, I wrote him a very brief choose-your-own-adventure style letter. Basically. I mean, it was like maybe 5 or 6 pages. I sent it out to him. He enjoyed it. I found out later on that he basically shared it with several of the people in his boot camp there, and they all really actually quite enjoyed it. So maybe I'll bring a copy of that down.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, nice, actually, Chris.
Yeah, it went real well. So,
all right, the third and final one's a little bit more complex. I'll try to boil this down quickly, and once again, there will be a link in the show notes if you want more details. Throughout the con, there are going to be several Pathfinder Society compliant games. Okay, so if you're into Pathfinder Society, or if you'd like to start but haven't up until this point, they will be able to help you through either pre-generated characters or doing character generation on the spot. But these are going to be Pathfinder Society games, fully legit by their organization. There will be an entry fee of $3 per person. Once again, 100% will go to the charity. And throughout each of these games, people are going to be scored on stuff like the best role player, best kill, funniest person. The table gets to elect an MVP. Those folks will then go on to a finale game in slot 6. And anyone who didn't win their way in can also attempt to buy a spot by getting a roll off for an additional $3. And whoever takes the final title at the end of the con will be given a trophy, an honorary title, and a $25 Paizo gift card. Now, the final slot, the final championship, will not be a Pathfinder Society game. It will use full Pathfinder rules and randomly assigned characters. But the ones prior to that will be Society events. So if you're looking to support this charity or even just looking to advance your Pathfinder Society character, here's your opportunity to do it. So all great stuff to check out. All right, second thing on the hit parade before we get to the trial of Johan. Responses are in for the Power 16-3 round 2.
Dun, dun, dun.
Which means as of this episode, round 3 will begin. I'll go ahead and read them off.
I'm starting to sweat.
Oh, I'm excited.
The Shadow Rifts League, the 5th bracket. Master 3. And by the way, all of these were close. These were all within the 50 to 40 spread. Okay.
Holy cow.
None of these had
heated
a runaway
battles.
Winner. Yes, very heated. Master 3 Balls versus the Pat Soundboard.
I have to vote for Master Three Balls. I'm going to be happy either way because I do like Pat Soundboard.
Who doesn't?
55.1 to 44.9. The Pat Soundboard goes on to the next
round. Oh, yeah. Oh,
very nice.
Oh, he got kicked in the nuts. This is
bracket six. Episode 200 versus Gnarlgate.
Ooh.
Another. All these were close.
The unfortunately dead versus the never living.
It's not Gnarlgate.
You're going with episode 200. You are correct. 54.2 to 45.8%.
Let's go 200.
Barrel League, fifth bracket. I have to start by reading the Time Cube AI's quote for this particular one. Once again, taken straight from the Time Cube site. Belly button logic copyright. Does have a copyright notice on this. Okay, so I want you to know that all rights reserved to him. Belly button logic works. When does teenager die? Adults eat teenagers alive, no record of their death. Belly button is signature of your own personal creator. I believe her name is Mama. Pastor told his flock that God created all of them, but the truth is that they all had belly buttons. Liars. Versus the Seasons game.
Tell it like it is, Time Cube. Hallelujah.
How can you argue with that logic?
Apparently most people couldn't. 56.9 to 43.1. This was the broadest spread we have, I believe. Oh, no, I take that back. One is broader spread. The Time Cube AI goes on to the next round. And the Time Cube AI will be facing the winner of the sixth bracket in the Barrel League. Bill Cosby versus John Giambot.
Beep, boop, 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 boop. John Giambot.
Gotta go, John.
Since John is the closest thing we have to a young white Bill Cosby, it does seem a bit like shadowboxing, but 57.8 to 42.2, John Giambot did win. So yes. We very well could have a Pat versus John finale.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And the finale, we're going to run the next bracket for 2 weeks after this episode drops. And then the finale, we will run up until Fear the Con, and we will announce the winner at Fear the Con on the Fear the Con live episode.
Nice. Sweet.
I'm going to miss that episode. I'm not going to be there for that. I'm going to have to find out like everybody else, and it's going to be really exciting.
Stop being such a bitch. Be at the con.
I'm sorry.
I don't want to hear your excuses. I want to see you at the convention. Well, you're going to be there for Friday, but...
I will be there Friday. Yeah. I'll be there Friday, right, blowing up mechs and hopefully making players cry. That's my goal.
Johan, this is the first trial we've ever had on Fear the Boot. Uh-oh. Because a forum user outed you for a pretty serious crime.
Uh-huh.
Now, I did not recognize this crime simply because I am so unfamiliar with...
I knew this was coming.
It's trappings and lingo that I didn't even recognize the signs. This is like when a gay friend refers to the Friends of Dorothy, okay? You're either in the know or you're not, and I was not in the know, and so this had to be explained to me. After our previous bonus episode where we talked about miracles...
I was just listening to that episode on the way up here, as a matter of fact.
I was pondering, I wonder if we have a full-blown juggalo who listens to this show. And should we do a round table?
More than one, in fact.
And should we have a round table with that person? This was suggested by a forum user, just like we did with LARPers and furries. At that point, someone pointed out that your forum avatar is the cover from the 1994 Insane Clown Posse album, Ringmaster.
That is correct.
And before we changed your name to Johan, your previous handle was Ringmaster.
Fuck avatars, how do they work?
So John has already suggested, when I told him this, he responded with Fear the Con 6, Miracles. And I think we have found our
conventions,
theme.
How do they work?
But are you in fact a juggalo?
I would not describe myself as such. However, had you asked me that question, say, 15 years ago, you probably would have received a different answer.
So what, this is just like lingering identity? Like
it is. That's a large portion of it. I've been going online by the handle of Ringmaster for 15 years. So it's just the name I use. That's the avatar that goes with the name. So yes, it is very much just a lingering affectation. I also find most juggalos to be entirely amusing.
Have you ever consumed Faygo?
Yeah, it's actually pretty good. It's basically Vess. It's just Vess from a different state.
Do scientists piss you off?
Well, often. Yes, they do. But most people do.
Can we find a picture of you on lookatthisjuggalo.com?
Not that I'm aware of. However,
I'm sorry. I got the website wrong. It's lookatthisjuggalo.com. juggalo.tumblr.com.
There was at one point a picture of me for about two frames in a video on ICP's actual website from a concert because I was in the front row with face paint. So,
did you ever get to meet Ass Dan?
I do not believe I did. Okay. I don't even understand the reference, I'm afraid.
The reference comes actually from a Saturday Night Live skits where they make fun of Juggalos. There's this reoccurring character in these skits. His name is Ass Dan, and he apparently dies in every skit. And that's his Juggalo band name is Ass Dan.
Though my taste in culture may be low enough that I listened to ICP extensively at one point in my life, my taste in culture is not low enough that I watch Saturday Night Live. So.
Have you ever worn the black and white face paint?
I think I already answered that question. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Not nice. On a regular basis, so, but I did wear it to a concert.
He's also a Kiss fan, too. I mean, come on.
As the presiding judge of Fear the Boot, I'm going to tell you right now, I see probable cause to hold this over for trial. Now, in all fairness, you do not have representation present. You have until your next appearance to consult with Johnny G and put your defense together, at which point we will put you on trial. I will be the judge, and we will allow a jury of your peers, perhaps this will be an online survey or something on the forums, I don't know, to determine your guilt or innocence as a Juggalo, after which I will pronounce sentence if they find you guilty. But in the meantime, I will question you no further until you have legal representation. So court has appointed Mr. John Grana to represent you in the matter of the Fear the Boot community versus Johan, accused of the Class A felony being a Juggalo.
Word.
You have about a month on that. Alrighty, let's talk about a couple other things here. Let's talk about some role-playing game-related stuff now that we've gotten this dirty laundry out of the way. Wayne needs to come on here and say something awkward just to make me feel less awkward.
So, out of curiosity, is the user that outed me the one who has a Psychopathic Records logo as his avatar?
I think so. I don't remember. I should have noted the user's name, because usually I credit forum users for their actions. However, that will be entered into the record for the trial. Oh, I will go back and read that, and I will look that evidence up. Well, it's up to John. He may bring as a character witness this individual. He may also be a prosecution witness. I'll appoint a prosecutor in the meantime. I might be Chad. I don't know. I'll find someone who's fit to be prosecution, but John will be your defense lawyer.
What are you going to do?
There's a little exercise, which we mentioned several episodes back, that we as the hosts are engaging in.
Kegels.
I'm doing them right now.
If you can clap.
Right now, I have a bag of charcoal briquettes, and I'm turning them into diamonds.
You go, girl.
Help me find the keys, and we'll drive out of here.
Yeah, boy.
The point of this exercise was... I can't even go into this next, you guys. The exercise we're doing is called Stone Keep, not the Kegels. And the point of Stone Keep...
I like that visual, though. Stone Keep. It works.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is actually, because of the fact that several of the hosts have never gamed together and therefore don't get how each other games. This campaign has not yet started. It will probably start, I believe, next week Wednesday. So it'll be a week after this episode drops. But we have already at least set the basis for the campaign setting. We've done the character concepts and write-ups. All this is on the forums. I'll put a link to it in the show notes. And we did do a session of brief setting orientation, character creation, working out the group template, making sure everyone's characters were linked, so on and so forth. Amongst those of us that sit within the St. Louis group and game together all the time, that's just the way we normally roll. And I think we have come to internalize some of it to the point that it's second nature. We don't even think about it, talk about it. We don't even realize things we do that may be good ideas, bad ideas, or even just different ideas from how other people game. So, Johan and Chris, I am curious to hear what you guys took away from that session. What surprised you about how we did things, or what is different than how you have done games in the past?
The single biggest difference from my perspective is the sheer amount of time that went into character creation. Not taking into account the lead up to it, in which we were all discussing character concepts on the forum ahead of time, just that session and sitting by itself was probably far more time than I've ever spent on character creation in a campaign before.
Dude, I'd have to agree with that. It was, I could probably on one hand list the number of times in my entire gaming career that I've ever spent an entire session just creating characters. It just is not something I normally have done. You know, yeah. Or done, I should say, to that extent. I mean, certainly you would spend maybe part of a session creating a character.
Possibly and then an hour.
Jumping right into things, but never the whole thing.
Out of curiosity, how do you handle that, though, if you come into a session, create the characters, and immediately roll without knowing a whole lot about the characters or the group? Do you just have something super generic? I guess let me back up and explain why I like to spend that much time on the characters. And there's really two basic reasons. One, we have found a role-playing campaign, just like any long trip, goes best with plenty of planning. That you can cut out 99% of your problems just by setting things up right. By making sure everyone's gone to the bathroom and everyone's packed their extra underwear and whatever it is you've got to do to keep people happy throughout this trip. But the second reason is because I want the game from the very start to be personal to the characters. And if I don't know what you're playing or how you tie together, then I can't do that. The most I can throw at you is a very generic encounter and maybe customize it a little bit with improv, but it's not really going to be all that deep or personal because of the fact that I didn't know until 5 minutes ago what the hell you were playing anyway. And so I'm curious, what do you guys think of this in context of that? Do you think it's a good idea, bad idea, different idea?
Well, I would say in the context when which it was presented, I think it did work very well. I mean, saying, you know, that this was unusual, you know, doesn't mean that I didn't enjoy the process. It was fun to do it this way because it was different. To kind of go back a little bit to part of your previous question, you know, for me and starting things off, using my most recent campaign as an example, we did spend part of the session creating characters and getting that going. But once we got through the mechanics part of it and then jumped into a little bit of setting background and a little bit of setup done by me as a GM, we then kind of went ahead and got into it. And I did that knowing that there wasn't going to be any serious amount of depth that was going to happen for any of the characters, because this is, in a certain sense, it's an intro session. You are, in a certain sense, generically kind of getting into it. You have that small base and hook that they can latch onto and then go. And then after that, once we've begun, the deeper background information I take from the characters and the questionnaires that they may have, you know, filled out after we've already started gaming, and then start weaving some of those things in there. So it's almost like, to use your trip analogy, which, by the way, for all of my campaigns, I actually do those things. I make sure that everybody goes to the bathroom and that everybody has packed extra underwear when we sit down at the gaming table. But to use that analogy, basically we grab a few things, jump in the car and go, and then stop at Walmart along the way to pick up everything else that we know we're going to need, and then continue on the trip. You still get there, you still have a good time on the trip, and you still have everything you need once you get there. But you're preparing along the way rather than preparing everything beforehand.
Yeah, and that's not all that far off from the way we've traditionally done it amongst the people I play with. Generally speaking, what will happen in our setup is each individual player will talk to the DM ahead of time, independently of everyone else, via email, via telephone, face-to-face. Give a rough idea of this is the kind of character I want to play, more mechanics related than anything else, but also baseline of personality and history if they happen to have that ready. Then the DM will almost always fill in the past, say, X number of months of history for everyone. So it might be a matter of, okay, you guys have all been shanghaied by pirates. You're on this pirate ship. You've been here for 9 months.
So that's an interesting approach that the game master creates the group template as opposed to the players collaborating on a group template.
Correct. And that's pretty much always how we've done it.
I guess as far as what the game master creates template wise is maybe a good chunk of the setting, and then the characters imprint what they want onto that setting. And there's plenty of room for, you know, flexibility in what they want to try and do. I don't want to say it's less collaborative, but it's a different kind of collaborative.
I would agree that DM does create a lot of the group template in as much as we're talking about the why of why this group is together. That is almost always set by the GM in the games I've played. So the DM gives us the reason that we're all together, that we're all the same place, that we're all working toward the same goals. We usually play a session or two, get that under the belts, get accustomed to our characters, and then retcon histories for our characters after that. So after we're accustomed to the character, after we've gotten the feel for just organically how this character is playing, then we fill in, okay, well, this is what her childhood was like. This is what, how many brothers and sisters he has. You know, this is where he's from. Things of that nature.
What you just described is something that even using my own style of gaming, I find myself doing with characters all the time. And I know, Pat, I think you've talked about this. Several of us have talked about this, where you really don't get a sense of what a character's like until you kind of take them out for a test drive.
Yeah.
So as a result, there is a lot of stuff where I may come to the table with a well-developed personality and background, but there are things that I will either change or add or flesh out in greater detail once I really understand how this character works and where this character and I gel.
My tendency is to have sort of an outline of a background for a character. I don't like to really go into a lot of detail, fleshing everything out before you even sit down and start to play it, because for me, it is so fluid. There's just a lot that I don't know about the character until I start playing it. I liken it unto that typical actor's thing of what's my motivation, but I just can't wrap my head around a character until I really sit down at the table and start just doing some RP with the others in the group, because I can have an idea of what I think this character is going to be in a vacuum. But when you start interacting with other people, it almost always just gets blown away for me. And I discover new things. So I think I'm more toward like what Johan and Chris have described and what I've done in the past. So really interacting with you guys in the last several years of what my gaming has been like has been new to me. It's a different way of doing things. It's, you know, how you guys have done it up here. So I've learned a new way of doing it, but I think I'm come more from your guys' camp, I believe, Johan and Chris.
Yeah. And I think part of the reason for me why it's just kind of evolved this way for me over time is the desire to really just get into it. Let's get the mechanic stuff out of the way that we know we're going to need, those nuts and bolts for a character, and then grab a hook of an idea that leaves enough for interpretation later on, and let's go. Let's go have some fun. We're here to have fun. Let's have fun. Now, that said, what I have found very interesting is when we got done with your session, Dan, and all of the character creation was done, I mean, all the way down to gear purchasing and everything, I had that same feeling. I was like, I want to get going. I got this character. I like her. This is going to be kind of fun. I'm looking forward to this. Let's go. Oh, damn it. The session's over. However, that, you know, now as we've talked about it and we've gotten closer, and even when we were getting closer to our first start date, the anticipation to start was greater than what it was in, you know, previous sessions before, when I knew we were going to go and we're going to sit down and make characters and go. I was excited to the game, but this is a little bit different because it's like I got to see the person I'm going to be going out with, but I had to go home right away. But now I'm going to be able to go out on that date, and the anticipation, the excitement for it is actually a little bit higher, a little bit heightened.
I think one of the reasons that we ended up falling into the habit of doing things the way that we do it is the sheer volume of dead-end games that we started and failed and died, because there is few things more frustrating than the third consecutive time that you sit down with a group of people to make characters that you don't ever get to play.
Oh, God, I'm so glad that someone else has experienced this.
Oh, over
trauma
and over
pain.
And over again.
I have bitched about this on the mics before. So I'm, you know, because yeah. Yes, I have done the same thing. We have played the new game, you know, the new shiny. We get this damn game and we sit down for one or two sessions figuring out characters and getting a group together and getting ready to play. And then we play it like once and then that's it. And oh my God, it just enrages me because I devoted all this time and effort into doing these characters and we're done, never to be seen again.
That happened the last time I actually did a game with a setup like this one, where we actually took an entire session to sit down and make characters, which we did this way partially because the system almost required it, I think, and partially because we were new to the system and had to learn and teach each other how to do things. But it was Spirit of the Century,
right?
Which requires really a fairly lengthy character creation process, especially when you have never played anything quite like it before. So we took an entire session, made characters, we played one session, and have never touched the game since.
You know, the thing that really frustrates me the most about doing that and going through and making up these characters and then never touching on them again is because for me, and I know that other people don't feel this way because that's what I'm going to bring up here in a second and complain about, but I make that character for this game and that's it. That's where I want to play him.
Right.
I've heard a lot of people say, well, just recycle it.
No.
Just take that character and use it in some other group. And I'm like, that's not how I work.
No, you can't.
I made that character for this.
Those people are insane.
I don't transplant this character to some other game.
I wanted the insane people, because there are...
There are. Beth can do it. You do it. It's just like, I don't do that.
Well, there are some characters where I played them in a campaign long enough, they're forever in that world. I can't picture them in another world. But with these games where the character got made, not played very long, or wasn't played very well, or got screwed over by the GM, whatever, I have found that I can at least trim away some of the details, get back to the core of this is what attracted me to the character. It was this trait of personality. It was this bit of background. It was this angle, and readapt that character to another setting, generally with ease. And obviously not every character works in every setting, but I have a laundry list of characters that I would love to revisit. Characters mm-hmm. that I want to recycle because either I was not able to play them enough or because I would simply like to try playing them again. But I think there's another distinction here, and this does not figure into either the length of character creation for my games. As I explained before, I have two reasons for doing that, and neither of them are what I'm about to state. And secondly, it does not also figure into my proclivity for killing games, but I enjoy character creation. I like making characters as much as I like playing the game. I know a lot of people don't. They hate the process of character creation. But I love coming up with characters. I mean, it's just as much fun to me as writing and executing a plot as a game master. I have a ton of fun sitting down and working out who my dude's going to be for this game. And so while I am not fond of our quick cycling of campaigns, and I'm glad that between Chaz's D&D game and now this BattleTech game, we have weathered storms. I have never seen my gaming group weather at any point in my history. I'm glad we're keeping these campaigns going.
It's my influence.
But, and partially it is. But even if that was not the case, it would not bother me for a simple reason that I like character creation. I understand why you don't, but I do.
Well, mm-hmm. I like character creation.
Me too.
However, I like to play the character once I've created it.
Yeah, that's
I enjoy the process of creating characters. I get a kick out of it. But when I'm done creating it, I want to play it. And if I can't play the character I've created, I find that incredibly frustrating. And it ruins the fun for me if I don't get to carry on and actually play
this
character.
My biggest thing is the fact that I've been burned too often before. Mm-hmm. I like making characters. I don't hate character creation. But I do think I've sort of adapted my style of making a character into a discovery more so than a sitting down and thinking it all out beforehand. I like the journey that is making a new character. And for me, that figures well beyond just the initial concept. You know, that's getting into the playing and then discovering what that character really is.
Awesome. Well, we'll leave this one here, but I cannot wait to revisit this after the first actual game, which I guess will be two or three episodes from now, and see what you guys think about how I actually handle the first session and whatnot. I do want to say, though, in closing that...
Conversely, Dan, I'm actually looking forward to seeing how you as a GM react to us as new players at your table. And also, I'm curious to see how Johan, how his style is, you know, either similar or different to mine. I mean, this is going to be a very interesting experiment.
My style has more face paint, Chris.
Does it? Oh, yes. Excellent. Well, I can groove on that.
From the bench, I'm going to advise you not to speak on this matter any further until you've had representation. In closing, the only thing I want to note is that normally our character creation sessions, while they do typically take up the whole first sitting, I think that one was a bit unusually labored by the fact that it was remote play, we were struggling to work out a voice client that would work for everybody. We were trying to get used to Map Tool. Several people had never touched it before, so we had to orient on that. A couple people were not familiar with Pathfinder. I mean, we knew D&D 3.5, but didn't necessarily know Pathfinder. So we had several bottlenecks that were a bit unusual to the circumstance. While I do typically devote one sitting to character creation and group creation, it's typically not that labored because of the fact that we don't have so many other hurdles getting in the way. All right, moving on, we are going to talk about a topic that we left from our last regular episode, which was recommended off of our Twitter feed, and this one is setting bloat. Now, we said that we would keep this gentleman's internet points in escrow to see how we did at blackjack on the ship. However, I am not going to stick to that for the simple reason that after watching some of the things that have occurred and then coming home and doing some research on how casinos are conducted in international waters, I'm fairly certain that we were getting screwed.
Oh, I don't see how we weren't. My ass still hurts, Dan.
It was not.
And not in a good way.
Yeah, this was not, we played the game poorly or the house was having a lucky streak. This was like the dealer had 21 damn near every hand.
I don't know how they did it, especially whenever you would factor in, Dan and I were at the table and we would have, we started the table, it was just the two of us. Then we had people sort of straggle in. So at one point we had a full table, I think, or there were five other players, but then that whittled back down to just the two of us. But it was uncanny, the this dealers would come up
oh with. Yeah, if you had a 20, they had a 21.
Yeah,
if you had blackjack, they had 21 with a face card up, so it was a push.
Yeah, we saw two blackjacks get pushed in the time, that has to be, the odds of that have to
and
be
in dozens of hands
low.
I saw the dealer bust like two or three times.
Oh, I know.
I mean, it was
a, yeah.
All right, so I point being though that since cruise ships being in international waters are not required to get third-party audits and regulation the way that a state casino would, I will never gamble on a cruise ship. But enough about that.
Sorry, sir. We lost your internet points.
Yeah. Well, no. So what I'm going to say is that we will simply release them from escrow with no further comment. So you still have your other five internet points. You have your full 10 now. But the topic is setting bloat. And kicking this around prior to rolling, it sounded like we all had a slightly different interpretation of what this topic meant. I guess this is what happens when you have three topics suggested in 140 character tweet, and there's not a whole lot of explanation there. Let me start off with how I interpreted setting bloat, and then we're going to talk about how the other guys interpret it. Because like I said, we each had a slightly different angle. The complaint that I have when it comes to setting bloat in a game is that it's irrelevant to my game. All right, so I go out and I buy a new role-playing game. And I get my rule book, and maybe there's a separate setting book, or maybe it's one of those things where the front half of the rule book is rules and the back half is the setting, like what Rifts does, for example. One of the things that I find in there a lot that irks me is the fact that what they're telling me is the story of the setting. They're not equipping me through the setting to tell my story. So I grab, and this is just an example, a Forgotten Realms book, and there's tons of stuff in there about this war and that war and where Elminster was and where this character was and where that character was. But what I'm not seeing enough of necessarily, and this depends on the release of Forgotten Realms, some of them are actually really good in this regard, some of them are really bad, is the stuff that's like, well, that's great, but I'm not picking this up to get the footnotes on Ed Greenwood's novels. I am picking this game up because I want to tell my story in the setting. And what I wish they would do is spend less time carrying on about really detailed history and characters. Sure, give me stuff to hook the characters on, our characters. But what I want is things to equip me for our story. So when we walk into a town, I know who's in this town. Who are they going to run into? What gives this setting character? I mean, look, I bought your setting because I didn't feel like developing my own. But when all you do is tell me about Elminster and set me back to the point that I have to develop the setting myself anyway, what the hell is the point of the setting book? Now, once again, I'm picking on Forgotten Realms, but actually the edition I used did a wonderful job. It has cities at a glance. It has maps of some of the cities. It really does give you a good flavor for what could happen in each town. But just thinking over my role-playing library in general, there's too much stuff that's about their story and not mine. It'd be like picking up a Star Wars book, and the first half of it's the RPG, and the back half of it is a recounting of the movies, and there's nothing in there to enable you to tell your story in the universe.
That's what the first half's for.
Well, and listening to your description of this, I'm trying to wrap my head around it because I don't really GM, so I'm coming at it from a different perspective. But is this sort of a forest in the trees kind of a thing? Because it almost seems like the setting that you're talking about is macro. You're talking about the big picture, sort of the forest, making sure that you get that down, because that is sort of the overarching feel of the world. But what you're talking about is, your story is going to be more focusing on the trees, and the individual trees. And that's, really.
It almost sounds like, going with what Pat just said, it's almost like it's the story of the forest rather than the forest itself. Because I think, Dan, what you're saying is that you could work with a forest, but not necessarily if someone there was telling you about the forest and how the trees grew and how the needles spread during the summertime and the wintertime and all of that kind of crap.
I'm going to be honest in saying that even I'm losing myself in our tortured analogy. So let me try and just explain it without an analogy.
Oh, come
I demand
on.
Analogy.
This is Fear the Boot. We have to use force in the trees.
Well, I'm fine with that, but even I've gotten loss on what's a tree and forest and pine needle and undergrowth.
I was
and
fine
squirrel.
Until the pine needles, but
I like how the pine needles spread.
Here's what I'm trying to say.
You like that? You can tell I definitely have deciduous and coniferous knowledge.
We're going to sit down and run a game of Battletech. Now, the fact is, you guys as players, let's say I'm the game master, you guys as players have created characters you care about. Let's take our current campaign. You've created a mercenary corps which has a history you've written, is in a story you care about, and has a future you care about. The fact that the War of 3039 is occurring is cool stuff. That serves as a backdrop that enables me to tell your story, because we can find out what happens as you guys go throughout the War of 3039. But the setting that is most useful to me is things like, what's on these planets? If I know that this group over here went over there, and this is exactly what happened, and this is who lived and who died, well, how does that help me tell your story? That tells me their story. But when I can take something like Objective Raids or go to Sarna.net, which is a great online resource, and I can look up information on the planets and say, oh, well, on this planet, there's this factory, and here's some really cool stuff, like that whole thing of I did in that one game about communications being interrupted by regular magnetic storms. That was from the setting description. Well, this helped me tell your story of what happened when you guys went to this planet. What's occurring in the inner sanctum of Hans Davian and Theodore Kurita and all that stuff? Cool stuff, made great novels. Stackpole did wonderful jobs on them, but that is not the story of The Right Company, which is what you guys are playing. And so That's what I'm talking about. Is I want things to help me tell your story, not things where they're just wanking or reiterating their story.
So it seems to me like what you really want to get at then is
building blocks.
But you want to have even more. And what I mean by that is I don't think you want to get rid of the political interplay that is sort of the prose of a world.
I wouldn't want to get rid of it, but I would want to see it downplayed. I want shortened footnotes.
Sure.
If I want the full version, I'll go read the novel.
And that's
all I want to know is what, give me the high level stuff so I know how to get my group into the action.
Right.
Without breaking the general overarching consistency and mega plot of the setting.
I think the prose and everything is very important for a setting, because I think those are the fundamental building blocks of whatever world or setting that you're in. I mean, it's important to know, like in Star Wars, what happened with Darth Vader and
and
Luke, all this kind of thing. And the political interplay, like you're saying, with Hans Davian and what's going on in the war. I get what you're saying. You don't need that for what we're doing, but it still does affect the world as a whole, because those are the major power players.
And let's say, using your Star Wars analogy, which is the same one I used earlier, I gave you a Star Wars RPG where the first half of the book is rules and the second half of the book is a play-by-play of the movies.
Yeah.
That's great. I'm not saying it's useless information, but effectively all I'm doing is still leaving you in a vacuum where if you guys want to go off and tell your own story in your own place, where you're the heroes and you meet different aliens and different plot lines, you have to write it all from the ground up anyway.
Right.
Okay. So how did I help you with that setting?
Right.
I really didn't.
Well, it seems to me then that I'm looking now at setting bloat as my definition. The bloat would be the detailed information like you said you got on Cerna.net or an online resource that develops all the planets in the Star Wars galaxy
right.
and talks about the populations. So in my mind's eye, setting bloat is a good thing. In that term.
Well, you know, we're using
this resource.
Well, let's clarify, though. We're using bloat here in the negative sense. Bloat means it shouldn't be there. Setting material is one thing. And maybe even a setting has a lot of material. What we're talking about here is what's the point where the setting material becomes too much? It's superfluous.
Okay. Well,
when someone is bloated, they're not at their ideal weight.
I find it kind of interesting because when I'm thinking of setting bloat, the image in my mind is almost 180 degrees opposite of what you're talking
about. Right, and let's move to your definition.
When I think of setting bloat, I actually see it more often as too much fine detail. I almost never have an issue with the broad overarching stuff in a campaign. I've got no problem with book after book of Forgotten Realms talking about the War of 39, 27, 800, whatever, or how many of the Seven Sisters Elminster did. All seven of them, by the way.
Eight of them.
Eight.
Yes, eight very of nice. Them.
You know, I've got no problem with any of that. The problem in my mind with setting bloat comes in when every last street corner is detailed and every last town in some supplement somewhere.
Right.
And that's okay in theory, but at the table, it becomes very problematic unless everyone knows the setting equally well.
So they go from giving you useful hooks to effectively micromanaging.
Right.
How yes. things ought to be.
And that's in my mind what setting bloat means, is when the fine details have become so overwhelming that there's nowhere left to go.
Well, pre-recording, you also pointed out that kind of setting bloat invites a different kind of monster.
Right, which is the setting lawyer. And that's where I was just about to head with, you know, when you have 180,000 supplements that detail every single building in every single town, then when your group walks into town and you say, oh, well, you go down the street to the Color Animal Inn, then Fred sitting across the table says, no, we don't. The Color Animal Inn is in town B. We're in town A, where it's the Colored Feathered Bird Inn. You're an idiot. Here, look, it's on page 37 of supplement 8B right there. And the bartender's name is Bob, and ale costs 3 silver.
I almost did this to somebody in a Battletech game years ago. I did not do it, because even then I had the sense to realize what a douche move it was. But we were in a situation where Force A was doing something to Force B, and I pointed to the game master. I said, look, I know a lot more about Battletech than you do, so I'm not going to act on this information. But as a side note, I could fix this with a phone call. It'd be like, all I'd have to do is tell so-and-so what's going on, and pretty soon half a dozen regiments would land on this planet and straighten this out. Now, I didn't do it, but you absolutely could invite that kind of douchebaggery if you have someone at your table.
Right.
The sort of thing that I would love to see in a setting that kind of runs the middle of those two, between your complaint and my complaint, is something that is, one, encyclopedic or indexed in nature. And I don't mean that in the sense of it's completely exhaustive. I mean, it's organization. It's topically oriented. I can look up a city or look up a race and get information on it. And secondly, I wanted to give me enough that I get the flavor they're going for, but they've not defined every street corner. Here's some flavor stuff. Here's some actionable items. Here's some interesting groups or people they might run into, but it is not so detailed that anyone can really lawyer it. So right. it's easy to find on the fly. It's quick to work with. It is designed to enable and color my game, but it is not so defined that I have no room left to maneuver.
Yeah.
You know what I think also, too, might be interesting for that kind of thing? Taking this from a little bit different angle, you know, and let's use Battletech as an example, just because it was this very ongoing universe, and there's a definite overarching plot line that the game manufacturer did on purpose as they went on and on and on. What I think might be kind of fun with some game supplements, if once they've just laid out the basics of their world, is present a few possible timelines and allow you, as either a group or a GM or whatever, to pick ones, you know, and detailing out, here's one way the history could go based upon everything that's here in the campaign setting. Here's another way it could go. Here's another way it could go. And detail those three or four plot lines out and let you, you know, choose which one you might like.
Chris, let me ask you a question on that, though, because one of the other versions of Study and Bloat we talked about that what you just described, if not handled correctly, could almost promote is you just have too much stuff. And the result of too much stuff is that it's intimidating. I was commenting to you guys earlier that the email I get most frequently at my account, since I stopped managing the general mailbox and Chad took that over, the email that is most frequently addressed to dan@feartheboot.com is, I want to start playing Battletech, but holy crap, there's like a billion books. Where do I even start?
Right.
Now, yes. And I realize some of that is because Battletech is a somewhat confusing game because it's a war game married to an RPG. But even once they get past that, it's like, there is so much setting. There are so many books on this house and this war and that war and this organization and this aspect of the universe. And people are like, what the hell do I do? If you present someone with all these alternate timelines, aren't you kind of running the risk of effectively handing someone something that is so intimidating simply by the sheer volume of possibilities and potentials and explorations? It's shock and awe. You just lock up at the sight of these 45,000 books.
I think a lot of it depends on how it's presented. Let's go with the assumption that the book lays out, here's where everything stands at year zero, and then lays out that information to whatever level of detail we're all happy and comfortable with and feel good about. Okay. Then it goes into and properly sets up saying, you know, a chapter essentially titled, where do you go from here? And lays out the fact that here's what we're doing for you. Here, we're in the next few pages, we're presenting possible avenues you could take. Do not feel compelled to take any of these, but you can certainly develop your own. But here are some avenues that you could take. That, I think, could help overcome that issue. You know, and I think, too, you're talking about Battletech. I think that problem is compounded even more so now in the fact that they've got it broken up into different eras that you can play in, which can make it even more intimidating at that time, because you look at, well, there's the Succession Wars era, there's a clan invasion era, there's a jihad era, there's the Dark Age, you know, there's all these different eras to play in. Where am I supposed to start? I have no idea. But they're slowly starting to get much better handle on that, so it's not so difficult for new players jumping in.
Battletech is also an example, though hardly alone in this regard, of setting creep, where as the timeline moves forward, as you release more novels, more supplements,
more of the authors become creeps.
Well, that too. But you You start to effectively explore so much of the world. Those books start to stack up because you're trying to move that product. I mean, hell, in my edition of Forgotten Realms, and I've got two, I've got the third edition one and one of the earlier ones from second edition. And the second edition one, they have this list of areas that they promise they will never develop in the supplements or the novels. And I don't remember what they all were, but I remember one of them was Sembia, which is why I started running most of my games in and around Sembia. Well, guess what? They've now written novels set in Sembia, and they've now done all kinds of detailed setting explanation of Sembia. And that little corner of the universe that was previously unexplored is now defined in great detail amongst the stacks of Forgotten Realms source books and novels and whatever else. I think that's something else that RPG makers have to be very, very conscious of, is you have two audiences eternally. One is, yes, you have the hardcore fans who have been with the game or the universe since the start. They want more. They will pay for more. You enjoy writing more. You'd be an idiot not to keep doing it. I'm not saying games should not have additional source books or novels or whatnot. But what I do think they have to do, in addition to making that information accessible via a good layout and index and whatnot, is I think you always have to have some product, something, both for rules and setting, that is basically like, if you have never touched this before, here is the little spoonful of the universe. And at the end, we will help you figure out what you actually care enough about to explore from here.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something that I think a lot of these things, as they grow over time, fail to do, is they stack the books floor to ceiling, but they never really back up and say, okay, wait a minute. What if you're new to this? Why don't we give a book that introduces you to the rules, gives you the real simple stuff of the setting, and gives you an idea of what's out there and where you might want to look further. Or hell, don't put it in a book. Refer people to an online FAQ so you can update it all the time as new books and stuff come out, where you can help guide people to the resources they want and keep them from wasting time or money or just being scared to death by the resources they don't even care about.
I think in my mind, a setting has reached the point of setting bloat when, upon deciding to run a game in this setting, the first thing I have to do is sit down at a table and announce to my players, this game will not be canonical. Once I have to do that, the setting is bloated.
Right.
Anything up to that point is fine, because that means everyone's in agreement about everything that exists in the setting, and we all know it approximately equally well. When it gets to the point that there's too much for any or all of us to actually understand, comprehend, and memorize, it's no good. You have to make the non-canonical announcement, which may or may not be okay, depending on whether you've got that guy in the group that just loves that setting.
Well, I think doubly so if your non-canonical announcement is not about future history, but is about the present.
Is about the present, right. Yeah, I mean, non-canonical in the future, I think that's a requirement anytime you're dealing with an existing IP and running a game in it. You have to announce non-canonical. Otherwise, what's your group doing? Because the future's already set and they're not allowed to change it. I would have a hard time envisioning how you would run an interesting campaign.
You could. You just have to find a way to make trivialities very interesting.
Right.
Which can be done.
It can be.
That's a different topic for a different show, though. The trivial versus the epic and comparing and contrasting of what's in between. But different topic for a different show.
Right, right. I guess what I'm getting at is when you have to actively sit down and make an announcement regarding the existence of setting and what is or is not actually there, you've got a problem.
Right.
Whether that's a problem for everybody, it probably isn't. You know, there are certainly groups and individuals who love it, who will buy it, who will game it. That's fantastic. There are settings that I would run canonically. Were I to have a group that knew it as well as me, I would have no problem running a, say, a Wheel of Time game. I love the setting, probably could run it very much by the book. There's 20,000 pages of source material for it at this point, just in the novels alone.
Right.
There's plenty of material to go on, and I wouldn't mind doing it, but there's others that I just would never do, and that's most of them. You know, I would never run a Star Wars game without that announcement of, this is not going to be canonical. I don't care what Wikipedia says. That planet's not there. Shut up. Star Wars and Forgotten Realms are the two that always jump to my mind with this problem. There are others too, but those are the two that are huge, they're massive, and they're big in RPGs.
I think that's going to do it for setting bloat. There's some thoughts that we'll make them back to in a later episode, but I don't think we need to explore that specific thought anymore right at the moment. So as always, I want to remind you guys to go out and check the show notes. There are a ton of links, especially from the stuff I talked about at the very start of the episode that you'll want to go check out. Vote on the Power 16-3, Round 3. Also check out the stuff for the charities at Fear the Con 5. And beyond that, have a great week.
Oh, wait, one more announcement. I had something as where I was doing a little bit of Facebook live blogging the thing here.
Okay.
And since I got in trouble for not doing the shout out that came during this last time.
Yeah.
Casey Campbell wanted him to let everyone know that this is a Fear the Con 5 related announcement. Danger Brewery tonight, while we're recording, is cleaning the kegs for Fear the Con 5.
Awesome.
I am glad they are cleaning the kegs.
Me too.
That
he doesn't
makes
say
me
what
happy.
They're cleaning them with, but he says they are cleaning them.
Hopefully Comet. Thank you guys for tuning in, and we will catch you next time.
Later days.
Clown love.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2012. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.